This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to start with talking about teen dating violence. We've never done this on this program before, and that's what we're going to do. My guests are Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court and Andrew Kane, supervising attorney for the Legal Advocates for Children and Youth program of the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. We'll be referring to that as LACY, standing for Legal Advocates and Children and Youth Program. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California. Additional funding is provided by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. Judge Hyman, thank you very much for coming back.
Thank you for the invitation.
Great to have you back here. And Andrew Kane, thank you very much for joining us. It's your first time here.
It is. Thanks for having me, Chuck.
I wish you'd tell us something about LACY. I think it sounds to me from talking to you before the program is it's rather unique to Santa Clara County, but I think it's something that I would hope other counties would take seriously and perhaps want to copy.
So, Chuck, LACY's been in existence since 1990, and our mission throughout has been to provide free and confidential legal advocacy and representation to youth who are in need. And we have a wide variety of programs, some a little more new than others. I think to start with the newest and right now is what is one of our most prominent is that we're providing court-appointed representation to all the kids in the Santa Clara County foster care system. So we have about 1,700 clients through that program that we're providing representation to in juvenile dependency proceedings. But beyond that, we've had programs that have been in existence much longer, including, of more relevance to tonight's program, working with pregnant and parenting teens, so providing them legal services surrounding child custody, child abuse, and child support. And a slight subset of that has been working with victims of teen dating violence. So if a teenager calls us, indicates that they have been in an abusive relationship and would like some legal protection, we can counsel them through that. And if they so choose to use the services of our office, accept representation.
What does that mean by legal protection?
So under the law, a victim of teen dating violence or domestic violence can seek a restraining order. Within the California Family Code, specifically the Domestic Violence Protection Act, if you have been a victim of abuse or neglect from a dating partner or somebody else who you've had an intimate relationship with, you can seek an order that would require them to stay away from you or require them to in some way restrain their personal conduct.
Does this also involve, if there has been some teenage dating violence, if a young girl, teenager comes to you and complains about this, does this mean that your organization will contact the police? How do the police get involved with this kind of thing? Because if it were domestic violence for adults in a domestic relationship, obviously if the police were called, they'd come right out. What happens in a situation involving a teenager?
So as a legal services provider, our attorneys are bound to follow traditional rules of attorney-client privilege. It doesn't matter.
So you can't. Okay, go ahead. Pardon me for interrupting.
That's okay. So regardless of the fact that our clients are almost predominantly minors, we're still bound to respect confidentiality. So if a youth comes to us, indicates that there is some kind of problem within their relationship, but doesn't want us to disclose specific information or any information at all, we're bound to respect their wishes in that regard.
So you are not a mandatory reporter to
Correct.
The police?
Correct. I actually sometimes colloquially call it a mandated non-reporter because we get situations, I think fairly frequently, where we know that outside service providers who we could collaborate with would be able to provide a holistic package of services to our client that would be beneficial. But if they don't want us to disclose certain information, then we are bound to respect that.
What happens with the young man who has attempted to rape this young, you know, young by young man, I mean a teenage young fellow who has attempted to rape his date? What happened to him? I mean, she gets to LACY first. It's first come, first serve. If he wants to come to LACY, you can't represent him because that's a conflict of interest because you're a lawyer.
Correct.
Other people in your office are lawyers. So how does that young man get any help whatsoever? And he probably needs it.
So specifically in Santa Clara County, if the young man in your situation is looking for legal assistance, we do have a small network of other free or low-cost legal service providers in the county, and we'd be happy to refer that gentleman to those services. Mm-hmm. But because we already have an existing attorney-client relationship with the young lady in your scenario, we would not be able to provide him any sort of legal advice.
So what kind of help might he get? I mean, obviously, someone like this who tries to rape his date is really off on the wrong track. And I don't know what the statistics are, but that's something. If he does not get into some kind of treatment program or something like this, he's probably going to have a problem for a long time. What do you suggest, Judge, on this?
Well, if he's criminally charged, he's going to get the public defender.
Oh, sure. Of course.
And if your scenario is that they have a child together and he needs treatment, then Mr. Kane is correct. He's going to need to be referred to someone else, and they're going to have to assist in another way that doesn't involve a conflict.
Here's a question from someone. It was just brought into the studio for both of you. But attorneys are officers of the court. Aren't you required to report crimes despite attorney-client privilege? Now, I think that's a good question. It's not my question, but I think it's a good question. I think it may come from a lawyer. what do you say about this, Judge?
Well, generally, I believe the answer is no.
Yeah.
I think there have been proposals to change that, whereas if you know for sure that your client is about to commit a serious physical wrong against someone specific, the proposal is that you have an obligation to do something
about
it. But
legally, you don't have the obligation to do it.
Not yet, certainly.
I know there's a case, and I can't remember the name of it, where a psychiatrist...
Tarasloff,
yes. Okay. A psychiatrist who had a client, a patient, telling the psychiatrist that I think he wanted to kill somebody,
right,
or something like that. The psychiatrist did make a referral.
I don't think he did.
Oh, he didn't?
Which is why he became the case name.
Okay.
He got civil liability because I, as a judicial officer, have a couple of times been notified by therapists that are treating someone that maybe had a family law case with me or something like that, that the person was talking about harming me. And so I got...
Harming you?
Harming me, because
wow,
I made a decision that they didn't like.
How did you deal with that? Do you carry a gun?
I notified the sheriff's department, and they in turn talked to the therapist, and they made recommendations to me in terms of public safety, in terms of my personal safety, rather, in terms of how to handle it. And it turned out not to be something that
was serious.
That was serious.
It was just hot air, thank God.
Well,
or not quite.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing is, because there's civil liability, that when in doubt, a therapist is going to notify.
Sure, of course.
As I said, I think there's proposals in many states. I know it's been talked about in California, but I don't think there's
really
been any legislation proposed that you have to do something about it. But right now, complete confidentiality.
Lacey just deals with young people under 18. You don't deal with young adults who are 18 and older, I presume.
So our office case acceptance criteria does have some room for flexibility in it. So, for example, if somebody who had just crossed over to the age of 18 contacts us and is looking for some legal assistance, we'll consult together within our office management team. And if it seems like a case that would require a short-term level of assistance, or if the youth is still on track to graduate from high school, for example, that might be a case where we would step in. And then we also have a couple programs that are a little bit unique to our office that work with youth up to the age of 24.
Mm-hmm.
And those are youth who are considered to be at risk for homelessness or are runaways, as well as youth who have transitioned out of the foster care system.
Mm-hmm. Do you find, with the financial situation that our state is in, which is not good, and most counties are facing big deficits, do you find that domestic violence, both in your organization, Lacey, and you judge in your court, the Santa Clara County Superior Court, generally speaking, has increased?
I think I can speak to it really just both anecdotally from my individual perspective as well as what I understand of general statistics and what service more direct service providers would say. So I think the direct answer to your question is yes. Mm-hmm. Anecdotally, we have seen an increase in calls from teens who have been victims of dating violence within their relationships. And I think statistically it's shown that in times of rough economy that domestic violence and dating violence usually see surges.
Do you find in this situation with the teen violence, are the parents aware, the teenage young woman who has been violated, are her parents generally speaking aware of this or not?
When I first started doing this work back in 2006, and to familiarize myself with this area of law and some of the social practice around it, I did a lot of research. And a statistic that to this day still jumps out at me is that a study found 81% of parents did not believe that teen dating violence is a problem. And I don't necessarily think they were speaking to their own children. I think mm-hmm. they were asked a very general question as to whether they saw this as something that needs to be addressed on a community-wide level. So that statistic to me would suggest that the answer to your question is a lot of parents don't see it as a problem.
How about you, Judge? What do you think about the general public? Do they see it as a problem or not?
Oh, absolutely not. They certainly don't see adult domestic violence as a problem, and therefore by definition, teen dating violence or interpersonal violence is going to be even less of a concern because, after all, pulling hair, pushing, that's just kind of part of puppy love. But I wanted to get back to your last question to Mr. Kane just for a second. One of the concerns I have when we start talking about an increase in violence because of the recession, depression, whatever, is to make clear that I do not believe that poverty causes domestic violence. I mean, it can be co-occurring that just like substance abuse doesn't cause domestic violence, it can be co-occurring. So that when you put a family that has issues under additional stress, in this case financial stress, you're going to have an increase in the violence because of that additional stress, but it isn't the stress itself that is causing the violence. What's that is perpetrating domestic violence. What perpetrates domestic violence is a desire by one person to control another person by means of mm-hmm. Violence and then fear. And so I would not want people to jump to the conclusion somehow that poverty is the cause of domestic violence, because it's not.
Do you think sometimes, Judge, do you think sometimes defendants in domestic violence are also victims?
Oh, absolutely. I think that that there are people who are charged with domestic violence who... I have no idea what the percentage is, but let's say where there's dual arrests, that is, they arrest both partners mm-hmm. Because they haven't been able to sort out in terms of who was the primary perpetrator, primary aggressor, or because sometimes training issues, they aren't able to differentiate. Also, even if it's not a dual arrest situation, there's going to be a certain percentage of people that were unfortunately a mistake was made that the person who was more controlling and more vocal was able to convince someone that they were assaulted by the other person. Mm-hmm. So it absolutely happens. I don't think it's a large percentage, but it does happen.
Chuck, can I follow up on two things?
Yeah, please. Of course.
I wholeheartedly agree with what the judge said about the distinction that needs to be made between poverty not being a cause of dating violence and domestic violence, but rather a co-occurring factor. And the power and control point that the judge hit upon is
the
real key here.
Mm-hmm.
domestic violence at its fundamental core is about power and control. There are so many types of domestic violence and abuse that we see. Physical abuse, sexual abuse are the ones that I think most people think about when they hear domestic violence. But there's financial abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse. Those are the things that when people who are more experienced in this field, we see that and we recognize that those are indicators of power control. But I don't think a lot of people who are less practiced in this area really see that. So I wanted to really reinforce what the judge was saying there. And if I just one other point, Chuck, a second thing the judge said, which I really want to expound upon, the judge made the reference to the puppy love aspect. I think there are far too many people in the community. And I think a lot of us, even in the legal community, are guilty of this, is looking at teen dating violence from the standpoint of you've got two kids, and what we may, with adults, really view as domestic violence, we simply view it as teenagers being teenagers. And in a lot of cases, that is so far from the case. The issues that teen victims go through in dealing with the people who have abused them in their relationships are just as critical and just as important for us to address as they would be if they were adults.
Well, what I want to do, frankly, is I want to give people a chance to call in and talk with you. Actually, I want to let you know this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're talking about teen dating violence. We're expanding it beyond that, of course, also into domestic violence. We're going to take a break for just a moment here. Our number, if you would like to call in, is 415-841-4134. Whether you are a teenager or the parent of a teenager or the friend of a teenager or you're a teacher who's seeing something going on that you're not happy with or you're a counselor or whatever, I would like you to take advantage of the fact that I have these two very experienced people here that you can talk with. So the number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. My guests are Judge Eugene Hyman of the Santa Clara County Superior Court and Andrew Kane, Supervising Attorney for the Legal Advocates for Children and Youth Program of the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. If you're interested in finding out more about what we refer to as LACEY, let me give you the internet address for it, www.lawfoundation.org, lawfoundation.org. If someone, again, if you would on this, Andrew, if someone in another part of the state, because we do record this program the first half hour and we send it out to a number of stations, Radio Bilingue, which is a group of stations in California, run the program about a week delayed. They may want to find out more. And so if they go to www.lawfoundation.org or if they were to call your office and say, I've got a problem down here, what can I do? Is there any way that you can give them some direction in their part of the state as to where they might go or what they might do?
So what people who view our website, one of the things they would see is that we have a general intake line, and that's for youth, other members of the public, or service providers to contact us and seek assistance, whether it's just legal advice or tips or full-blown representation. So if we were to get calls from people outside of Santa Clara County, and we get those all the time, not just from California, from people who come across us on the web from other parts of the country as well, and if it's not seeking assistance in our county, we would do our best to try to find a referral or a provider in their jurisdiction that we would be able to refer them
to. So you would go that far to do that?
We've been streamlining in our office our referral system, and we've done a good job, and so that would really help us. I think one of the challenges we have is there really aren't that many service providers in the state, and I'm not overly familiar with what goes on across in other states that really tailor their legal services just to kids. That presents a little bit of a challenge for us, but we would still make the effort to find them an appropriate provider.
Here's a question that was brought into the studio. Sexting. For those of us who don't know sexting, I'd like some definition of that, if you would. Can either of you give us a definition of sexting, S-E-X-T-I-N-G?
Well, my understanding of it, and this is not a legal definition, this is more of a social networking definition, is that, as the name suggests, it's anything that involves sex. It can be texting with sexual content in terms of one person, I'm thinking of you, and this is what I would like to do with you. Another person saying, you know, I'm available, whatever, and up to and including pictures. And if you had the capability with your cell phone, even short clips.
I see.
And that would include nudity.
Okay, but it's not physical contact with a person. Sexting is really sending communication.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
But it can include pictures of people doing things.
I see. All right. So here's the question: sexting has become very popular among teenagers. Do you think there's a connection between sexting and the increase in teen violence? That's one question. And should parents be more concerned about sexting and try to discourage it? That's a second question. What thoughts do you have on this, Andrew?
So the answer to the first question is I believe it is. And I think it's not necessarily just isolated to sexting. I think as technology has increased, we've seen a wider landscape of forms that abusers are able to use to exert that form of power and control over their victims that we talk about. I've had several clients who I've worked with for long periods of time who have shown me long strings of text messages they've received, sometimes of the variety that we would normally classify under the sexting category, some that are just more of a harassing nature, that clearly indicate that the abuser is trying to exert that power over them. So I do think that's a critical issue.
And one of the things that concerns me, not just with respect to juveniles but also adults, is that the abuser will coerce the victim into allowing him, and I'm using him, to take pictures of her naked or other kinds of photos and share with his friends.
Really? Oh, my. Okay.
And, you know, I mean, in terms of the percentage of situations where that's happening, that I don't know. But I do know it's another way of power and control. I get the pictures, and if you don't do what I want, I go ahead and I share them or I release them.
Oh, my.
Or the real way to really hurt is to say, hey, I'm going to show it to your parents.
Oh, my. Wow. Let me ask you this, going a little bit beyond this, so that we expand the program just a little bit. If we have adult domestic violence, and let's say whether it is something that a mandatory reporter has reported, had found out and reported to the police, or let's say the alleged victim has reported to the police. The police come right out, don't they? Under California law, they're required to come out and they're to take a report, perhaps make an arrest if necessary. Judge, what comments do you have on this in terms of both from the victim standpoint as well as the alleged abuser standpoint?
Well, each community decides for itself in terms of the kind of response that they're going to have. In Santa Clara County, and I suspect in San Mateo County, San Francisco County, most counties, if the police come out and if they are satisfied that they have probable cause to believe that a crime was committed and that a person committed it, they're going to arrest. There's all kinds of federal money that's been involved in training on this issue for mandatory arrest policies, for mandatory prosecution policies. And this has been going on for quite some time under the Victims Against Women Act that has been renewed twice now. So there, whenever you have federal money that is being funneled for these purposes, it usually results in certain arrests and prosecution. My concern, of course, is that everyone be trained. That is, that the prosecutors that are doing domestic violence cases know everything there is to know about domestic violence, and also those that are doing the defense of these kinds of cases also know everything about domestic violence for two reasons. Number one, the people those of us in the community are entitled to have people that are prosecuting give the best representation to us as victims or the community. And likewise, those that are accused should be entitled to have the best representation. And by not understanding the dynamics and by not understanding what domestic violence looks like, in my opinion, you're not giving good representation. The other issue is that things that happen in criminal court potentially have real consequences in family court because of presumptions, a rebuttable presumption, which means that it's not conclusive. In other words, just because someone has committed domestic violence doesn't guarantee that automatically something is going to happen. But because there is a rebuttable presumption, if someone's committed some type of domestic violence within 5 years, it's presumed that that person should not have sole legal physical and legal custody of a child and shouldn't be joint legal physical custody of a child. That doesn't mean they don't get visitation. It means that they aren't able to make decisions like medical, dental, social, in terms of religion, in terms of the Boy Scouts, football, those kinds of things. The reason why that presumption came into play was because children, obviously, is a very big subject area where batterers control victims by controlling children. So if I'm a batterer and you want the other partner wants to get braces for the kid, I might say no just to be able to control you. Whereas if the non-person who's committing domestic violence has the sole control of those kinds of issues, then there isn't the power of the other person. That doesn't mean that the system gets it right 100%, but it's rebuttable. So in the event, hypothetically, a victim of domestic violence were unfortunately convicted, pled guilty at an arraignment or something like that, it can be rebutted, hopefully. So that's just one issue where there's information that should be going back and forth and isn't going back and forth.
I want to ask you more about that as we go into the second half hour. We've come to the end of the statewide version of the program. And what I wanted to suggest to those of you who will stay with us, we will have some questions. By the way, I want to let you know that in 2 weeks, we're going to have our yearly Call a CPA night. So you better get your tax questions together and join us for Call a CPA night. That'll be on March 17th, whether you listen to the program live or not. If you remember, Wednesday, March 17th at 7:30, and call 1-800-525-9917 with your tax question, you'll be talking to a CPA. It is actually about 2 minutes before 8 o'clock at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. My guests are two very knowledgeable people in the area of the domestic violence. One is Andrew Kane. He's the supervising attorney for the Legal Advocates for Children and Youth Program of the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley, which is referred to as LACEY. The phone number there, if you're interested, is 408-280-2461, 408-280-2461. The internet address is www.lawfoundation.org, lawfoundation.org. And you're very quiet tonight, and I would like to invite you, if you are subject to some kind of a problem, domestic violence, whether you're a teenager, whether you're a teenager's a parent, whether you're an adult and you have some problem, you as perhaps an abuser or you as perhaps a victim, or you know of someone who may be either an abuser or a victim and have a question, a comment, you're concerned about what the next step should be, or you're embarrassed to seek help, and you'd like to anonymously call our program and ask a question, please do so. It's 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134, if you would like to join us. By the way, before we take any calls, I want to let you know, if you are confronted, as unfortunately so many people are, with just oppressive financial problems. There will be at the San Mateo County Law Library next week, Thursday, March 11th. You might want to jot this down. Thursday, March 11th at noon at the San Mateo County Law Library, there will be a presentation on bankruptcy for debtors. Maureen Lanez and Monica Murphy of the firm of Lanez and Murphy will provide an overview of the new law and filing options for those of you who may be considering bankruptcy. It's a noontime lecture. It's free. You can bring your lunch. And it's at 710 Hamilton Street in Redwood City. That's 710 Hamilton Street, Redwood City. If you'd like more information, you can call 650-363-4913, 363-4913. Again, I'd like to invite you, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, or problems in the area of domestic violence, whether it involves teens or adults, the number here is 1-415-841-4134. In that we have had no calls so far, I don't know whether that's good or not. My concern about this is that if someone is in an abusive relationship and is listening to this program, and the other person is there, they're not likely to call, unfortunately. I have had, certainly in over the years that I've done this program and throughout the entire period of doing this program, because we're now in the 26th year, when I've done a program on family law and we've been talking about divorce and if the parties are still living together, rarely will we get a call on the air from one or the other party. So I hope that you will feel comfortable enough to call in, but I certainly understand that it may be very difficult to do so. Also, let me mention this to you in case you are someone who looks forward to Call a Lawyer Night, as we usually do that on the fourth Wednesday of the month. We're going to do it on the fifth Wednesday of this month, March 31st. So you might want to jot down Call a Lawyer Night. That'll be 1-800-525-9917. Okay, what you were saying, Judge, is that the dynamics of people not understanding, but I do have, before I ask you this question, I do have a question that was also brought in. Talk about the popularity of webcams among teenagers, and do you think this has a connection to teenage dating violence? We hear about how teens become vulnerable to sexual predators. Is this a widespread problem, or is sexual predation through webcams exaggerated? Do you have some comment on that?
Well, I have a comment, but I don't have any studies that I can cite. This is just based upon anecdotal. The problem with the webcam is that it provides another tool.
For those of us who are not up to whatever it is, what is a webcam?
Oh, it's a camera that is attached to a computer that allows a person or persons to be able to view something. It can be looking at the ocean in Santa Cruz. It can be looking at the traffic on Highway 101 or 280. It can be anything. Mm-hmm. It can be anything that you people have cameras, nanny cameras in their homes that are hooked up in such a way that they can look at their homes throughout the day and see how the children are doing, the mm-hmm. animals are doing, and how the house is doing.
And they can be away from the home
yes.
and see this. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. I don't have this hooked up, but
yeah.
Actually, I have my court reporter does, and she can watch her cat. Fighting or whatever. I mean, I've seen
it. What fun to be reporting
yeah.
in the courtroom and see your cats fighting at the same time.
Sometimes
huh?
it's more interesting than what's going on in front of us, that's for sure. But in any event, the concern that I have is several-fold, but certainly from the standpoint of the abuser, this is another tool in the abuser's toolbox in terms of keeping control over a victim, because by the use of the camera, the person is able to follow remotely what the person is doing. So if the victim turns off the camera, walks away from the view of the camera, then the perpetrator is able to, next time they get together, is able to enforce the fact that you don't do that. It's another device on top of texting, on top of cell phoning. You know, it used to be in the olden days where pagers were used, you know, where the person would page and then the person would have to go to a landline and call. Mm-hmm. Well, now you can do it with cell phones. You can do it with texting and instant messaging and other Twittering and other kinds of Internet. But the camera allows someone to view what's going on in real time for whatever period of time. So if I want to make sure that you're at home, if you have a cell phone, you might be responding to my texts or my calls anywhere. But if I've got a camera on you at your computer at your home, I know whether you're there or not.
Tell me though, this is amazing. Tell us this camera that's on your computer, you being, let's say, the alleged victim. How does that work? How do you have a camera on the computer?
Well, first of all, they're very inexpensive. I mean, we're talking about less than $25. Now, the quality isn't going to be the best.
But is it set up? Is it installed on the computer?
It sits on top of the computer. Now, if you have an Apple, it's going to be part of the computer.
And part of the Apple computer, right?
Exactly.
See.
So, and you can use it in Skype and other kinds of communication software. But if you buy an inexpensive camera, I mean, Fry sells them, I mean, all these places, and they're inexpensive. Again, the quality isn't the best, but it serves the purpose of the abuser. You mount it and you say, hey, look, you don't leave this room without my permission.
Wow.
And, you know, I know if you're there based upon the fact whether you're on a camera or
so
not.
So if you, as the alleged victim, let's say, take something and a piece of paper or something or tape or, you know, tape that is not translucent, but you cover the eye of the camera, that's when the abuser knows this and the power trip comes on again.
Absolutely.
Wow. Go ahead, if you would, Andrew.
So I was talking earlier about how the use of technology plays into the phenomenon of teen dating violence and domestic violence as a whole, and this plays into that discussion. I think one of the things that we're seeing a really significant rise in is internet abuse, whether it's cyber stalking or cyber abuse, and things like using webcams or the social networking sites like MySpace or Facebook are really being used as tools by people who want to exert power and want to exert control. And I think for practitioners who are in the field, legal services, social services, really trying to address the underlying ways that people are exerting those things, that's one of the sort of next frontiers that we're going to be tackling is trying to minimize the ability to use these new forms of technology to commit these forms of abuse.
But part of that also is that courts need to be aware that this is going on so that in the criminal court, the court can issue as conditions of probation that the abuser is not to have a cell phone, is not to have a computer, is not to have any kinds of devices where he's able to control the victim in this kind of way.
Are the courts
kind of
doing that today?
If they're aware of it, I think they are.
Really?
And then one of the other things you do with respect to family court orders, if, again, you're aware of it, is to issue appropriate orders in terms of visitation. I mean, it's very common in visitation orders wherever there's a family plan where there's children that neither parent is to disparage the other parent in front of the child. That's, you know, that's a given. But you also need to, if appropriate, have orders with respect to that you can't do certain things with the kids. Mm-hmm. In other words, that you can't listen in on their calls. You can't monitor GSP in terms of what their, GPS.
GPS, where they are.
Where they are, if that's an issue.
Yeah.
And so the court needs to be aware if there's technology that's being used inappropriately in order to make the appropriate orders to deal with it.
Well, a comment would be that one of the problems is that parents are not up to date on the latest technology. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Well, a lot of people over 50,
well, yeah,
including judges.
It isn't
limited just to parents.
We certainly need more training. But going back for a moment, but let me do this. Let me do this. For those of you who have tuned in the last few minutes, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We started talking about teen dating violence. We're expanding the program into domestic violence. Generally, we're talking now about high-tech ways that the alleged abuser may control the alleged victim. My guests are Judge Eugene Hyman, Santa Clara County Superior Court, and Andrew Kane, Supervising Attorney for the Legal Advocates for Children and Youth Program of the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley, referred to as LACEY. If you're interested in perhaps contacting LACEY, whether you're here in the Bay Area or you're somewhere else listening to this program and want to try to get some referral to some organization that may help you, LACEY's number is 408-280-2461. This is for primarily teenagers up to and under 18, but they do have a program that goes to people who are up to age 24. Is that right?
We do have two specific programs, one that works with homeless and runaway youth, and another that works with youth who have transitioned out of the foster care system. And within those two programs, we can work with youth up to the age of 24.
Up to age 24. All right. Also, the internet address for LACEY is www.lawfoundation.org, lawfoundation.org. Now, if you've gotten to the point that you have a question, a comment, something you'd like to discuss with my guests, the number is 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. If you're listening to the program on the internet at www.kalw.org, that phone number is available to you also, 1-415-841-4134. Judge, I know that you are very concerned about the lawyers who represent, whether it's the people of the state of California, which would be the district attorney's office, or it is the defense attorney, people who can't, let's say, who cannot afford private attorneys will get a public defender in San Mateo County. It would be the private defender program, which is unique, pretty unique to San Mateo County. You're concerned about these people not fully understanding and having enough training. Would you tell us about that, please?
Sure. There's so many crossover issues nowadays, and physicians have to understand other systems of the body, even if you're a specialist. So if you're an orthopedist, you have to have an understanding of how
it's a heart in the body.
Exactly.
And a liver and a spleen.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you're concerned about blood pressure and things like that. Lawyers have a tendency, certainly in areas like San Mateo and Santa Clara, to specialize. And it makes perfect sense because there are populations that support specialization. Unfortunately, however, as a result of specialization, people are not holistically treating entire families. They just want to treat parts of it. And ideally, you would have one judge, one family, and that judge would deal with that entire family, no matter how many systems or divisions of the court they were involved in. But the reality is that until we increase technology and other ways of dealing with these issues, it isn't necessarily practical. What is practical, in my opinion, however, is information sharing. That is that the prosecutor knows if there's a family law case, a juvenile delinquency case, a dependency case, a probate case, which would be guardianship, something like that, and that all that information would be exchanged with the various representatives in those various systems so that there could be a holistic treatment of that particular family. There could be more consistent orders, and there wouldn't be problems that can be created by not knowing what's going on in other courts. But also more than that, because in every system you have different kinds of experts or evaluators. For example, in delinquency, you've got juvenile probation. In adult, you have adult probation. In family, you've got family court evaluators. In probate, you have probate investigators. In dependency, you have social workers that indicate. Everyone has their viewpoint in terms of how they examine this part of the family that they are dealing with. But yet people, as evaluators, aren't cross-trained. And the people that get the evaluations, the judges, the lawyers, whatever, don't necessarily understand child developmental issues, how domestic violence or substance abuse affects people at different ages with different types of challenges. They don't necessarily understand educational challenges in terms of whether the person is ADD, ADHD, whether the person has mental health issues, what kind of medications that they're on. So unfortunately, as a result of people not being cross-trained and as a result of people not understanding all these various issues, there's more reliance on the expert, where people defer mm-hmm. to the alleged expert. And that isn't always in the best interest of children either, because experts, just like lawyers and judges and everyone else, some are great, some aren't. Mm-hmm. But unless you have all this understanding and all this training, you don't know how to use the information that you're being given. And further, you don't know, because you don't have the experience, you don't know when to disregard some of this information mm-hmm. and to say, you know, this is hooey, and this doesn't make sense, and I'm not going to follow it, and I'm going to do something else.
Well lay persons would hope that the judge is all-knowing, but I think you're telling us that the judge also is not all-knowing. Is that true, generally speaking?
Absolutely.
So what does a consumer do? I mean, but when I say consumer, what does someone do who, let's say, is a defendant in one of these cases where you may have different things, you may have domestic violence, you may have in another court with another judge in the same county a family law issue, although I think in San Mateo, and I may be incorrect since I don't practice as a deputy DA and I don't practice in the family court, but I think when we have domestic violence in San Mateo County, I think that's in the family court.
You mean besides criminal?
Besides criminal.
It could be.
Yeah. What about in Santa Clara? When you have a domestic violence problem and you may also have a family law problem, maybe these people are perhaps going through a divorce.
Right.
There may be two different judges. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's what you're talking about.
That's what my concerns are, multiple.
Yeah.
One, in Santa Clara County, there is a coordinator. So the coordinator is constantly checking to see if people are in other systems.
I see.
Well, at least certainly if they're in the family system, and if so, to get information. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people that don't slip through for whatever reason. They're mm-hmm. not found. But then there's the issue in terms of whether or not they received the additional training. When I took the family law introduction course, and granted this was 11 years ago, it was a one-week course, and we spent one day on child custody, and part of that day had a psychologist. I wasn't taught developmental issues. I certainly understood that there were those kinds of issues, but I had to basically seek that information out myself yeah. or rely totally on the experts. Mm-hmm. And I didn't find that that was productive. Mm-hmm. And the same is true with everything, whether it be a substance abuse issue, a mental health issue, an educational issue. I'm not saying you have to know it as well as the experts. I'm saying, though, you have to have at least be grounded at least enough initially that you can at least ask the right questions.
Let me ask you this then. From the consumer standpoint, whether you are the abuser, whether you are the victim, how can that person who is not a lawyer determine whether or not he or she or they are going to get adequate representation? Or is our system such, you know, really practically speaking, is our system such that we get a certain limited amount of protection, representation, but not the ideal that you, judge, would like to see our system have? Is that basically it?
That's my opinion.
Okay.
that you're not getting what I would like everyone to get.
That's very unfortunate. How about, Andrew, I know you wanted to say something, and then I want to take a call from one of our listeners.
And I'll be brief. I just want to build on something that the judge said when he referenced holistic services earlier. And certainly everything the judge said about specialization within the legal field is correct. But when we're dealing with a problem like dating violence, it's important to expand upon holistic services to look at just legal services being one piece of the puzzle. In our office, certainly to do our job, we could help our client get a restraining order. We will have done the legal piece, and then we could end our relationship with our client. But in order to truly address the underlying problem, we need to look beyond the legal issue to what really brought about the problem in the first place. So our office employs social workers. So not county social workers, they're specifically employed by our office to really work with the client on some of those case management issues, try to connect them with case managers from other agencies, see if there are any financial issues, housing issues, or anything else that might be at play. And that's really going to be most effective in trying to address the underlying problem.
All right. We're going to and Doug, thank you for being so patient. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, hello there.
Hi.
I'm a teacher, and first I'd like to say hallelujah to the whole idea of taking a holistic approach to kids who are in legal difficulties, especially things like abuse and amongst abusing kids who are actually abusers. But that's not why I called. The reason I called is that I'm interested to know or to hear what the judge and your other guest has to say about teachers and other school employees reporting responsibilities if they suspect child abuse. And especially what I'm interested to know is if there's a threshold. I think the language says that if we have reason to suspect child abuse among that one of our students is a victim of child abuse. And I wonder if there's a threshold that, you know, where we can say, okay, now I officially suspect child abuse.
Let me ask you this, Doug, if you would. When you say child abuse, do you mean child abuse by another child on the alleged victim, or do you mean by a parent on the child?
It's usually in the home.
In the home. Okay, so you're talking about child abuse in the home. All right.
Right.
Let me get some comments first. I think you still had another question, but let's get some comments on that first.
Okay.
Judge, you want to start on this?
Well, my understanding of the law, and I'm not in a position to give legal advice, is that that the authorities, Child Protective Services, the police have to be notified. I would think that your district has policies in terms of notifying your principal or whatever, and then they have a notification procedure. So I think your responsibility is to notify someone who takes it on from there.
Someone in the administration.
Right.
Do you know what your policy is with your school?
Yeah, I'm very familiar with it. I could describe it to you if you'd like.
Well, I don't know that we have enough time. Okay. Is it one?
Clarify my question then.
Then go ahead.
And I want to know, and what I'm interested to know is that is there a threshold of evidence or anything like that that lets us say, yes, we now suspect child abuse is occurring? Mm. And the reason that I'm interested in this is that what will typically happen is a kid will show up at school with a bruise or something like that, or say that I go home and my brother beats me up every day or something like that. And a teacher will think about that and say, oh, I really don't suspect child abuse, and then let it go. But my understanding is that we're not to investigate, we're just to report.
Yeah.
Oh, and correct. You're not to invest. I agree with you. Yeah. You're not to investigate. Your responsibility is to report.
Well, let's take the one. The child comes to school, and here the child has a bruise. I would wonder, Doug, would you go so far as asking the child, how did you get the bruise?
Well, I would, but if a child came to school with an unexplained bruise, I would make a CPS report automatically. But other teachers would go ahead and ask, well, where did they get the bruise? And the kid would say, oh, I walked into a door.
Yeah.
And accept that explanation. But the language, if I'm not mistaken, says that you have reason to suspect. Well, you know, suspicion is not confirmation.
No, it's not.
So if I suspect, if I have reason to suspect, I report.
Reasonable,
And the reason that I'm so I'd like a really clear answer to this, and I don't think there is one actually, is that a lot of times my colleagues won't report because they say, "Oh, it's not happening," or "I don't believe the kid."
They don't want to get involved. That's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like.
Or it might just be that they just don't want to believe that child abuse is occurring.
Yeah, yeah. What comments, Judge, on this?
No, I think your responsibility is to, per your whatever your protocol is, whether you make the call or whether an administrator makes the call, you don't investigate. You have reasonable suspicion, and you leave it up to others.
You
to,
would hope that the administration would,
right.
would do
right.
something about it. Doug, let me take a breather for just a moment. I think you had another question, didn't you?
No, I just wanted
okay.
to clarify.
All right.
That.
Well, that's the best I think we can do.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for calling.
Hey, by the way, I love your show.
Oh, thank you very much for calling and saying that. I appreciate that very much.
Good night.
Good night. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KALW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. Call your own during the normal business hours. Ask them to find you a lawyer who has some knowledge, experience in the area that you're having the problem with. They'll find you someone who is experienced, set you up for half an hour consultation, and depending on the county, for half an hour, it could be a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. It's a great service. Nancy, we have about half a minute. Do you have a question that can go that?
I should have called earlier.
Well, that's all right. Try to be succinct.
My granddaughter, who is going to be nine, her father, her parents are separated, doesn't physically abuse her, but he emotionally and mentally abuses her. And I just, you know, is there anything...
You don't know what to do.
Right. I mean, he tells her she's stupid and he yells at her. And it's, you know, it's definitely taking a toll. And
what about the mother? Where's the mother?
Well, the mother is, you know, here. I mean, he sees her one evening a week and every other weekend. And
oh, he sees her. Okay, he has visitation rights.
Yes, and, you know, the problem is that the particular judge in San Francisco Family Court is so pro-fathers that it's almost impossible, you know.
Let me get some comments. It's a real problem, obviously, but let me get some comments. You're wondering what can be done, if anything, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So it sounds like there is a family law case and some sort of relief can be done through there. One of the things that we look at when we talk to families is the possibility of having some kind of, in the family law case, an independent attorney appointed for the minor. That's somebody who could actually be a voice directly for the minor. They have responsibilities to be advocates for the minor's best interests, but it's something that can be done. It's done in a limited amount of cases, but it could be sort of a neutral, objective person who could provide recommendations and positions to the judge.
Could your office be called to try to get a referral for this?
Unfortunately, it's not something that we can directly go to family court to advocate.
What should she do? What should this lady do?
So really, in that case, if the mother thinks it's an appropriate vehicle, if the case comes back into family court, it's really something that the mother should raise.
Okay. All right. Hopefully you will tell the mother that, Nancy. Thank you very much for calling. I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I want to thank you both very much for joining me. I think it's been very interesting. Judge Eugene Hyman, Santa Clara County Superior Court, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nice to see you again. And Andrew Kane, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Chuck.
Supervising attorney for the Legal Advocates for Children and Youth Program of the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley, LACY, www.lawfoundation.org. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Let me just mention to you that if you're thinking about whether or not you should set up a trust, for your assets, for your heirs. We're going to be talking about a variety of trusts available to you if you're interested. My guest will be the chair of the Estate Planning Trust and Probate Law Advisory Commission of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, Ken Begun. So I hope you join us for that. And again, I want to mention to you, we will have our big Call a CPA night on March 17th. You can join us at that time, 1-800-525-9917. Thanks for joining us, and join us next week. I'm Chuck Finney.